Hello, it's John Dennis here on Tuesday the 25th of August. Today, the Scottish Government has defended its controversial decision to free the Lockerbie bomber.
These were my decisions and my decisions alone. In considering these applications, I strictly followed due process, including the procedures laid down in the Prisoner Transfer Agreement and in the Scottish Prison Service Guidance on Compassionate Release.
Also today, a Guardian ICM poll shows an overwhelming number of voters now want the Tories to form the next government. And Edinburgh Awards judge Paul McInnes sees 60 stand-up comedy acts in just 3 weeks.
Almost every show is sold out. There's a real buzz around the festival this year.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis on guardian.co.uk.
But first, the news and a look at the papers.
Michael Jackson's death has been ruled a homicide caused by a mix of drugs meant to treat insomnia. A law enforcement official speaking to the Associated Press on condition of anonymity says the LA coroners determined the singer had been given a lethal cocktail of pharmaceutical drugs. Forensic tests found the anesthetic propofol combined with at least 2 sedatives. These developments raise the possibility of charges being filed against Jackson's personal doctor. Conrad Murray's already been named as the target of a manslaughter investigation. His lawyer says Murray administered nothing that should have killed Jackson. Follow developments in this story at guardian.co.uk/Michael Jackson. Labour's hopes of a summer fight back fuelled by Tory infighting over the NHS appears to have been dashed. An ICM poll published in today's Guardian gives the Conservatives a commanding 16-point lead over Labour. The survey carried out after Tory MEP Daniel Hannan's attack on the NHS on US television showed the rows done little damage to David Cameron's party. The poll puts Conservative support at 41%, which is unchanged since last month's Guardian poll, but down 2 points on a more recent ICM survey for the Sunday Mirror. We'll run through the numbers in more detail in just a moment. The US government's launched a criminal investigation into CIA interrogations. It says a declassified report reveals threats to kill a suspect's children and the use of an electric drill used to scare detainees. The document, produced in 2004 but released only yesterday, also includes allegations an agent implied a prisoner's mother would be sexually insulted in front of his eyes unless he spoke. The US Attorney General's now appointed a senior prosecutor to investigate claims of mistreatment. It could lead to criminal charges against the interrogators responsible. NASA has given a no-go for the latest shuttle launch.
Well, CJ, vehicle and the operations were cooperating, but the local weather unfortunately did not. We'll have to scrub for today, but look to try again tomorrow.
We copy that, sir. The crew will be ready when the weather is ready to cooperate. We'll be ready to go.
Storms around Florida's Kennedy Space Center have forced officials to postpone Discovery's launch. A lightning strike was reported just 5 miles from the pad. The shuttle's loaded with supplies for the International Space Station, including a new treadmill named for TV comedian Stephen Colbert. Today's papers now and the Mail and the Mirror are the only ones to get the Michael Jackson story on their front pages. The Times has been told the shortage of helicopters in Afghanistan can be traced to a disastrous Ministry of Defence decision to try and economise by designing its own software. Fewer than one crime is solved for every 1,000 closed-circuit television cameras in London, according to The Telegraph. The paper also calls the Prime Minister cowardly over his refusal to comment on the release of the Lockerbie bomber. The Independent reports on a study showing how ruthless women have higher levels of testosterone. An interesting line in the Financial Times on how an administrative blunder under the Thatcher government has opened the door for retailers to sell unauthorised DVDs and video games, including banned films and pornography, to anyone, including underage children. In The Guardian, how people who persist in illegal downloading will have their internet connections cut off. And The Mail has the story of how the father of West Ham player Jack Collison died in a motorcycle accident at the weekend on the way to watch his son play. There's more on today's stories and breaking news at guardian.co.uk.
Scotland's Justice Secretary has defended his decision to free the terminally ill Lockerbie bomber on compassionate grounds. Kenny McCaskill told the Scottish Parliament that Libya had promised not to give Abdel Basset Ali al-Megrahi a hero's welcome. He said it was a matter of great regret that Megrahi was received in such an inappropriate manner. It showed no compassion or sensitivity to the families of the 270 victims of Lockerbie. MSPs were recalled a week early from their summer break to hear McCaskill's statement. The minister hit out at the Westminster government.
I sought the views of the United Kingdom government. I offered them the right to make representations or provide information. They declined to do so. They simply informed me that they saw no legal barrier to transfer and that they gave no assurances to the US government at the time. They declined to offer a full explanation. As I said last Thursday, I found that highly regrettable.
After his statement, McCaskill faced a barrage of criticism from MSPs. The Labour leader, Ian Gray, said he'd made the wrong decision in the wrong way. And the Conservative leader, Annabel Goldie, questioned why Megrahi could not have been treated compassionately but kept in Scotland.
If Mr. Al-Megrahi's condition is so severe that keeping him in prison is inhumane, why could he not have been released to a secure house or a hospice or a hospital in Scotland? Is this SNP government seriously suggesting that our Scottish police, who cope so admirably with security arrangements for G8 leaders, could not adequately protect Mr. Al-Megrahi?
Severin Carell's our Scotland correspondent. Sev, how did Kenny McCaskill respond to that?
Well, he said there were a number of reasons. The first off was that he was told categorically by the Deputy Chief Constable of Strathclyde Police that in order to just give Megrahi protection at the house that the Libyan government have had for his family in Newton Mearns, which is a fairly wealthy suburb to the south of Glasgow, would take a minimum of 48 police officers to give him round-the-clock diplomatic protection. And McCaskill's view was that that was disproportionate. And in addition, Megrahi would also require extensive NHS services and to be clearly, you know, sent to specialist clinics or have specialist doctors visiting him. He was also asked and pressed about whether or not Megrahi could have put in some sort of hospice in Scotland. And McCaskill's position there was he just felt it was immoral. It would be grossly unfair, he said, to subject ordinary people, ordinary Scots who were in hospices to, you know, eke out their last few days, to have somebody like Megrahi in there with all of the circus, is the word that he used, of security officers and police and diplomats around him, because there has been for some time this dedicated Libyan consulate in Glasgow, which had up to seven officials, that was dedicated solely to looking after Megrahi and his family whilst Megrahi was in Greenock prison.
How much damage has all this done to Alex Salmond's government?
It appears to have done a huge amount of damage amongst people who are following the Lockerbie business in the United States. There's no doubt about that. And it's clearly caused a huge furore in Scotland. Though it has to be said that there seems to be a bit of a split. One of the Catholic Church's most senior figures in Scotland, Archbishop Mario Conti of Glasgow, issued a statement today welcoming and endorsing what McCaskill had done, as has indeed a Church of Scotland minister who's in charge of a particular Church of Scotland committee, the Church of Nation Committee, both applauding him, both saying that actually this was Christian charity, Christian ethics at its finest. But on the other hand, you've got all the other main political leaders in Scotland lambasting the SNP, lambasting McCaskill, saying that it was a gross error of judgment and that he overreached himself and has made Scotland a mockery around the world.
Even if we accept McCaskill's argument that he acted within the letter of the law, are there still doubts about the political wisdom of his decision?
Well, of course there are. I mean, that's the key point, really, because essentially what this is down to a matter of opinion. Was this the right or the wrong step to take? McCaskill's absolutely resolute. He's saying that his interpretation of the duties upon him and also the kind of wider ethical and moral duty to show compassion to somebody regardless of how heinous their offence had been was the principle that he had to hold uppermost. Other people are saying, well, actually, yes, you can show compassion, but you also have to balance that against the needs of the victims and also the seriousness of the offence.
And meanwhile, Sev, the UK government has cancelled a trip to Libya by Prince Andrew, who's going to be drumming up trade for Britain.
I think this is obviously for appearances' sake. I mean, the situation for both the UK government and the Scottish government is they want to, I expect, to try and see the dust settle. They realise it's going to be a pretty rocky few days, and in fact, the Scottish government is facing a new vote on this in the Scottish Parliament next Wednesday. That's a week Wednesday. And their hope is that once people get back into the normal working routine after the August holidays are complete, that this will slowly dissipate and slowly subside. The threats in the United States of boycotting Scottish products, most people regard as just simple, you know, internet chatter, not with much real substance to it.
Severin Carell, and there's full coverage today at guardian.co.uk/Lockerbie. Also on The Guardian's website today, Michael Biggs, son of the great train robber Ronnie, talks to Erwin James about his father's release from prison, guardian.co.uk/G2. Is this the end for Oasis? Asks John Harris at guardian.co.uk/music. And going on holiday with your ex sounds like a bad idea? Read what Amy Fleming says at guardian.co.uk/travel. Labour may have hoped that signs of an economic recovery and doubts over the Tories' commitment to the NHS would boost its political fortunes. But a Guardian ICM poll today shows the Conservatives command 41% of support, unchanged from last month, and they've gained ground on key policy areas. Our chief leader writer, Julian Glover, has the details.
Yes, it's pretty disappointing for the party. They've had a summer. I think they probably hope to have a bit of a fight back against the Tories. There's been lots of rows about the NHS, questions over Cameron's commitment to it. Pretty vigorous work by some of the people standing in for Gordon Brown. And maybe a hope that as the autumn came, the economy's getting better, Labour could begin to pick up. And this poll just shows they're stuck right down in the low 20s, 25%. That's the joint worst ever in the Guardian ICM series for Labour. And the Tories will be happy they're on 41% and on course for a big election win.
You mentioned the row over the NHS. What does it say about the public's view of how the Tories might run the NHS and whether they're trusted to do so?
Well, the poll probably first of all shows public don't really listen to politicians in August when they have slightly artificial rows about things. I think the NHS rows pass people by. But it's also, there isn't any sign of voters moving back to Labour on the NHS. The Tories, as the party with the best policies, or does Labour have the best policies, on health, the Tories have now closed the gap with Labour. It's the closest it's been for a very long time. And ask just sort of what do you think might happen, regardless of who you're going to vote, what do you think might happen if the Tories win the election? Most people, or more people, think the Tories will improve the health service and make it worse. The lead on education is even stronger. There's actually a majority of voters there think the Tories will make schools better. On health, it's 48%, so just below a majority. But people aren't that frightened of the Tories on health. As Labour would like them to be frightened. They'd like to think that voters won't vote Tory because they're worried. That doesn't seem to be happening.
And what about the economy?
Well, the economy, public are less worried about it. It's not so much the big issue as it was when we asked in February. And from that, you might think people will go, thank you, Labour, you're beginning to sort it out. But instead, the Tory lead is getting stronger. It's now, I think, 11 points is the best party with the policies. 11-point lead is the party with the best policies on the economy. It also leads the party best place to sort out the economic crisis, the immediate banking problems. And Labour's just fading on that. So people trust the Tories on the economy more than almost any other issue.
And we're just approaching party conference season, a time when there has traditionally been lots of plotting and so on. And we've had a series of stand-ins for Gordon Brown while he's been taking a holiday. Is the issue of Gordon Brown's leadership now very much back on the agenda?
Well, it probably will be when everybody gets back from holiday and starts writing up stories like that. I think what this poll shows, we did ask questions about the leadership. It shows voters aren't very clear about who the candidates are, and of course, nor is the Labour Party, and that's probably going to be enough to keep Gordon Brown secure. We did just ask, you know, if it was a choice between Gordon Brown or David Miliband, Gordon Brown or Alan Johnson, and a few other people, would you prefer Brown or Miliband? None of them really leap out as strong favourites. Miliband actually does the best. He matches Gordon Brown. I think 14% of voters say they'd rather have Brown, 14% say Miliband, and the rest say it wouldn't make any difference at all. Only person who would harm Labour is Harriet Harman. She's definitely toxic to the Labour brand. If she was leader, the party support would go down. And interestingly, she's less popular among women than among men, so it isn't even sexism. But if she did become leader, I suspect that 25% would be well below what it is today.
Julian Glover. My name's John Dennis. This is Guardian Daily. Still to come, the Edinburgh Comedy Awards and the Guardian Stand-Up Comedy Prize.
It's lovely to be in Edinburgh at the Fringe. It's the only place I've come across where you can have a very public row with your boyfriend on the street and earn 20 quid from tourists who think it's performance art.
But first, amid the deepest recession for decades, university graduates are desperately scrambling to get jobs. One of the biggest employers of graduates is BT, which said at the weekend it was closing its graduate scheme. But The Guardian reports today that most big firms are still recruiting university leavers, as economics correspondent Ashley Seeger explains.
There's some good news here for graduates in the sense that we've phoned around a lot of the big employers who take on up to 1,000 graduates a year, some of the big accountancy firms, the law firms, the banks. They're still recruiting. They find that in the past, when there's been a downturn, they've cut their recruiting, then they come out of a recession and haven't got enough good people on the books. For example, it takes 3 years to train an accountant or a lawyer, and so they tend to look ahead, and they got bitten last time. So a lot of them are still taking on graduates. In retail, it's the same. Still recruiting graduate management trainees there. Retail is doing okay in this recession, surprisingly.
And from the big employer's point of view, there's actually some good news there, isn't there? Because the students are taking it a bit more seriously than they have done before.
Yes, we spoke to one company that said students were all turning up on time for interviews and were accepting the first job that they were offered.
Extraordinary.
They weren't umming and ahhing and saying, perhaps I'll take this job, or perhaps I'll go and be a ski bum for the winter. They are seizing jobs very quickly, turning up on time, brushing their hair, sort of putting a tie on, that sort of thing, I think is going on, because graduates are finding, what we are finding from companies, the big companies, their applications are up hugely. They're up 30-40%, the number of graduates trying to get the number of jobs that are on offer. So we think the big companies are still recruiting. They can afford, they can ride a downturn. What we're hearing from universities and so forth is that a lot of smaller companies aren't recruiting or have cut right back. And so universities are saying their graduates are still struggling to get jobs, even though the big employers are generally maintaining their programs.
What are the chances then of a university graduate finding a job? You know, how difficult is it now?
I think it's quite difficult. It reminds me of graduating myself in 1984 during a recession. I know I don't look old enough, John, but it's true that the jobs are few and far between, and you don't get offered the three that you applied for. You get offered one of them if you're lucky. And there's definitely, in a recession, companies will cut back on recruitment because it's easier than sacking existing staff.
Meanwhile, Ashley, on the subject of the economic recession, there's been a bit of good news yesterday, a record surge in confidence among business professionals.
Yes, I saw that survey, and it's certainly true that the surveys are now pointing to things getting less bad less quickly, or that things have bottomed out. And you would tend to get an increase in confidence when people realise that things aren't still falling off a cliff. Does it mean we're going to have a rapid recovery? I'm not convinced. Perhaps we will. There's been a huge stimulus thrown at this recession in terms of interest rates at zero. Nearly 275 billion of quantitative easing is going on. A big budget deficit is being run to boost the economy. We should be starting to see the fruits of that now. However, we've still got consumers piled up with debt. We've got a banking system that's frozen, still not working properly. I think we're not out of this yet, John.
Ashley Seeger. The Edinburgh Comedy Awards, formerly the IF and Perrier Awards, are the most prestigious in comedy. Previous winners include Steve Coogan and the League of Gentlemen. Well, this year, one of the judges is Paul McInnes, The Guardian's entertainment editor, and he's described the process of seeing around 60 shows over 3 weeks as the jammiest gig at the Edinburgh Festival.
Oh, yes, I think so. It couldn't really be otherwise. But what's happened this year is that because a lot of people have been staying home, not going on holiday, there are huge crowds in Edinburgh, crowds from all over the world too, but particularly a lot of Scots, a lot of English. And so almost every show is sold out. There's a real buzz around the festival this year. And so I've been even more privileged, really, to be able to get into the shows in the first place. Now, that's not to say that everything I've seen has been brilliant, but it's really given me it's like being going on a comedy safari. I think I've seen every type of flora and fauna that's possible in the comedy world.
Well, who have been the big beasts on your comedy safari so far?
There's an interesting rule with regards to the Comedy Awards, which is that you can't consider for the award anybody who regularly plays to crowds of more than 500. And so one of the acts I've seen who wouldn't qualify in that regard is Reg Hunter. Now, he's the guy who a lot of people will know from Have I Got News For You? And he was hilarious. And that kind of polish is rare when you're seeing most of the acts on the fringe.
Edinburgh is kind of like, the festival is kind of like exams for clowns. It's sort of, you got to show your work, you got to show what you've been thinking about, you know, and what you've been experiencing. Stand-up comedy is a great account of where a comic is at. And if you see a comic doing the same jokes year in, year out, then that's a sign of arrested development.
And of the acts that wouldn't sell 500, of people you haven't heard of so much, people I've really enjoyed have been included Tim Key, who is, he's kind of got something of the Eric Morecambe and the Tommy Cooper about him. There's something deliberately shambolic. There's also a group called Pajama Men, who are, they're two guys. They only wear pajamas and they have no props. And so they basically have created a play which has about 16 to 20 characters, and they've managed to distinguish between all these characters purely through physical gesture and the clever use of their hands. So there's a couple of Brit emo rockers in there who have very funny hairstyles, and that's how you know who they are. Now, they're remarkably adept at doing this, and it's a real bravura skill that they have.
The Guardian's comedy critic Brian Logan wrote recently about a new wave of offensiveness in live comedy. Has there been much sign of that in Edinburgh?
Well, I think what I would say is that in terms of the real offensiveness, the stuff that used to get Ben Elton and his ilk up in arms in the 80s, perhaps not so much. That I think there's almost a consensus among comics that racism is bad, and there's lots and lots of comics will go for jokes about racists. So, and in a way, that feels slightly dated in itself.
Now, Paul, by the end of this week, you'll have seen 60 acts. Has the experience of seeing so much live comedy changed your view of what makes it good?
I think what I do know is that comedy will always be highly subjective. I think ultimately you've got to go with what makes you laugh. That ultimately, an act is good if it makes you laugh. But what can make you laugh can vary widely from person to person. But I think what I've also learned is that there are many, many other ways to skin a cat. That you can make jokes by not telling jokes. You can be incredibly funny through expression rather than delivery.
Paul McInnes. Well, the Edinburgh Comedy Awards shortlist is announced tomorrow, and we'll find out who's won on Saturday. But I can now reveal the winner of the Guardian stand-up competition. We asked readers to send us video clips of themselves being funny, with the first prize a slot on our Edinburgh Festival podcast, which you can listen to at guardian.co.uk/audio. And the winner is from Norwich, and she's Louisa Theobald.
Hello, everyone. Hi. I'd like to start with a piece of advice. Autumn is coming round the corner, and swine flu will again be a danger. I'd like you all to take precautions. I had a bacon sandwich on Monday, but I replaced the ketchup with Vicks Vapor Rub. So I think I'll be fine. For dinner tonight, pork chops with a Lemsip jus. Surprisingly Moorish. I can see some of you are a little bit cynical about the combination of medicine and food, but we all know when Nigella Lawson starts suggestively licking milk of magnesia off her fingers, you'll be converted, so get ahead of the game, people. But it's lovely to be in Edinburgh at the Fringe. It's the only place I've come across where you can have a very public row with your boyfriend on the street and earn 20 quid from tourists who think it's performance art. Cathartic and financially rewarding, shits on couples counselling. I used to work in regional theatre, which is essentially care in the community for the elderly in a shed. It was always a bit risky having a blackout between scenes in case a voice would come quavering from the back, "Have I died?" And it always used to make me so sad that their version of the afterlife was obviously a dingy village hall with an Alan Ayckbourn play on repeat. And rather than St. Peter at the pearly gates, an angel serving ambrosia, just a matronly woman shouting, "We've only got orange squash and wine in a box, so make your mind up." For the uninitiated, that was the Norfolk accent, a hard one to recreate until you think of a Cornishman having a shit. And there you go. You've been lovely. Thank you for having me.
Louisa Theobald.
Guardian Daily was produced today by Phil Maynard and Andy Duckworth. I'm John Dennis. Thanks for listening.